Yeah.
I don't know who that was, but it rocked. Who nice. Likes to rock? I like to rock. This is Robin on the Ink Studs, CITR 101.9 FM. This is a radio show where I talk about comics. I'm going to be real quick because I have a full hour-long interview I did with Melinda Gebbe. And she is the artist of Lost Girls, written by her new husband, Alan Moore. Mazel tov to both Alan and Melinda on their nuptials on the weekend. Nuptials, is that the right term?
They just got married?
Just got married.
Someone
on the weekend.
Just married Alan Moore?
Someone just married Alan. And they have the... go to Neil...
Have you seen him?
Yeah, he's styling. He's got Rings of Wonder. Go to Neil Gaiman's website, his blog, to check out some of the pics. They're pretty awesome. I wish I could rock the bowler hat like that. Yeah, tonight, Mark Bell and crew, Nagadod, along with, let's see, Jason McLean, Mark DeLong, maybe Owen Plummer will be there, will be at Sophia Books signing Nagadod and launching Melanie Sheepwash. Both great books of weird, I guess... arty goodness, psychedelia. Melanie Sheepwatch is a nice little chap book from Naive Press, who do books by like Kim Gordon, Wesley Willis, all sorts of weird, talented people. And Jason McLean and Mark DeLong are both very talented artists. And it's always good to support Vancouver people. That's tonight, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m. at Sophia Books. I will be there. I don't know if I'll be drunk or not. We'll see. And don't forget, Saturday night is the Comic Jam, the Vancouver Comic Jam. Next week, I don't know who the guest will be, but it'll be good. So without further ado, here we go.
Yeah. So I've got with me, my name's Robin, like I said before. My co-host is Don King, and we do the Ink Studs, which is a Canadian radio show all about comics focusing on alternative and independent. So,
What part of Canada is that?
We're in Vancouver.
Vancouver? Oh, my God. I've been to Vancouver.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was 13. Well, my dad was a Canadian citizen. I never became an American citizen. He was from Saskatoon. But we had relatives in Vancouver, and I swam in Nanaimo Bay, which was really cold.
Yeah, no, it's not the best swimming around here. It's either the cold ocean or the glacier-ridden lakes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I liked it plenty. I mean, I loved it up there. I visited Colonel Broom's dollhouse.
In Victoria?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I guess we'll start out. We have a bunch of questions about Lost Girls, and then also we have some questions about the your underground history.
Okay.
Just last month we did a focus on women in comics because of March 8th being International Women's Day. And you're one of the people I was hoping to be able to have on for it, but I didn't have things organized, so this will be, I guess, an afterword to it. So I guess we'll do the prelim question everyone probably asks. Lost Girls, how did it start out?
Well, it started out as a little comic strip for a magazine called Tales of Shangri-La. A girl asked both me and Alan to do a short story for this comic, and we got together and talked about maybe doing a story together. And then it turned out, as we were progressing, can I just pause for a second? I'm getting a bit of a feedback here. I can hear myself echoing.
Yeah, actually, so can we.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How's that? I just adjusted our settings.
Okay. I'm still getting the feedback.
Okay.
Yeah?
How's that? I turned out our headphones.
Okay, yeah, that's better.
I
can still get a little feedback, but it's not quite as confusing because I hear it at the end instead of in the middle. Okay, now where was I? Oh, yeah. So this little short story that Alan and I both were asked to each do a story for, we started talking about pornography because the story was supposed to be for erotic fiction. And I came up here and visited during the weekends, and we would just spend just hours and hours talking about pornography, talking about the problems of why it had not been successful as a whole social kind of literary and artistic thing, but was only something that was fit for, you know, like Grumbleweeds, something, you know, boys leave in bushes and stuff. And and out of that, we completely forgot the 8-page story and instead ended up talking about, is it possible to do a beautiful pornography that men and women would both like? And we started on that premise, and so then we started talking about what time period would be best. Alan asked me a lot of questions about what I would like because I had to illustrate it. And so we ended up picking World War One because it was a really interesting, not only was it a fascinating period in terms of the war, but in terms of fashion and in terms of what was happening in Bohemian society as well. It was quite fascinating. Women had gone from wearing stiff dresses with bustles to wearing long flowing clothes with very little underwear as opposed to before, and everything was kind of loosening up and people's minds were loosening up. And then in terms of the three characters, Alan again said, well, you know, what would be fun for you to illustrate? At this point we didn't have any sort of link that we were thinking of or anything like that. And I said, well, I'd done a story called My Three Swans about three sisters. And I said, I really like three women, a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead. Huh. And then Alan started talking about Peter Pan and how he'd always wanted to do an erotic version of Peter Pan. And then he said, wait a minute, you know, and he thought for a couple of minutes. And then he came out with this, you know, what about Wendy from Peter Pan? What about Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz? What about Alice from Alice in Wonderland? I think we've got them all here. And we both just sat there and stared at each other for a moment and thought, why hasn't anybody done this before?
It's interesting, actually. I read this morning the Three Swans story.
And, did you?
Yeah, I was looking through my comics, and the only old underground or semi-underground work by you I could find was that issue of Young Lust. It was in. I even tried hunting down some women's comics and some tits and clits, but to no avail.
I mean, probably all issues have been destroyed.
well used.
For the sake of those still living.
Well, it's interesting, though, that bringing up the Three Swans, because it's definitely, I see a lot of similarities in kind of really working at taboo topics. Well, Three Swans is more of a, I guess, comical, because it's part of the whole Young Lust series, and I guess that Lost Girls didn't really go as much into the comical. It still has that, like, very, you know, upfront, uncomfortable subject matter.
Yeah, I was going to mention, too, that after looking at the Three Swans thing, that the Lost Girls really does come across as being more you than Alan. That I wasn't expecting. Is that true at all?
Well, you know, that's a kind of. It's a denser question than you think. I don't mean dense stupid. I mean there's a lot of material there. It's a layered thing. It has to do with how much of a chance, I mean, considering the amount of labor that goes into the actual drawing. I mean, for the time spent, as I'm getting more into writing these days, it's my opinion that you spend an awful lot of time on art. That you could spend a fraction of that time on writing, and you would still give your reader as much or more than you can with a painting. It's a rather bitter sort of revelation for me at this point in my life.
Yeah.
But I think it can't help but it look a lot like, have a sort of a shape like me, because I put so much of myself into it. I mean, and Alan, a lot of what he did that was very subtle and that really makes it work is that he shaped his writing around the body of the art so that they fit together, so it seems, you know, like one person has done it. It seems
very seamless.
That the art is leading the story, because Alan shaped, you know, it's like shaping music around the dance. You know, and he waited on a certain amount of the story until I'd done the faces. I mean, probably two-thirds of the book, he added the writing. I mean, he mapped it all out meticulously before we started working on it. But in terms of the conversations and the moods, he waited until he saw those faces, and he fitted the words perfectly to go with the faces. So it looks like I'm in the lead, but that's because, you know, he's a very skillful partner.
Yeah, I'm assuming he kind of played to your strengths and just about
absolutely.
Everything.
Absolutely, you bet. I mean, everything, it was about playing to what he felt were my strengths. You're absolutely right there.
Yeah, that really comes across, because it does seem really seamless. Like it's yeah.
Thank you.
Now, it seems like you're talking about it's a kind of a transformation of time, like, I guess it's World War One, pre-World War One. Do you kind of see it as like it's part fantasy, like the importance of fantasy, but it's also, because of the time it's set in, it's like the loss of innocence?
Sorry, can you say that a little bit slower? I'm still getting some echo.
Sorry, I yatter too quick. I'm just wondering, when you're... coming up with the stuff, like, was loss of innocence an important part because of when the story took place?
So I heard the loss of innocence part. What was the last part?
Because of when the story took place.
Because of when the story took place.
Yeah.
Sorry. I've managed to hear a fraction of your question and not been able to make sense of it. Can you ask me it again?
I'm just wondering... loss of innocence and the era that the story took place, because World War One was really like a transformation of time, the way things were before World War I and after World War I.
And in the art world, like the it kind of was the story intentionally meant to kind of mirror the like the rite of spring and the sort of the loss of innocence with after World War I when war isn't so glamorous anymore.
I think possibly history is a history of loss of innocence to degrees. I mean, the generation we're born into, because we're innocent in that time, we see that as an innocent time itself, when actually it's all just a continual unfolding of forgetting and a re-forgetting and a reawakening. But yeah, I mean, I think it is very much the Stravinsky piece. I think is really, really important to showing the kind of I can only talk about it in terms of forms, the rigidity of you know, along with this flowing energy that I talked about earlier, this bohemian kind of flush of interest, you know, flirtation with ideas and sexuality. Against that, of course, the rigidity of war and the pounding rhythms in the ballet, which were very, very rigid and very savage. They broke into the old-fashioned forms of early ballet, which were kind of floaty and unassuming, kind of soft, like little things falling out of the sky or something.
Yeah.
And then suddenly ballet turns savage. Well, if ballet turns savage, what else is going to turn savage?
That's true. Also, I was going to, like, the look of the Lost Girls really, really echoes the a lot of the illustration from the turn of the century, too. I found that really interesting with the change of storytelling between chapters and things like that. I thought that was really awesome. Actually, I was going to say that the Rite of Spring was probably my favorite illustrated part of the whole book. I love that.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think it's actually Alan's and my favorite too, because I think we both feel that it broke into a bit of a new form, and it was very interesting to do that actually, because Alan's friend Steve had videoed a redoing of the ballet with copies of the original costumes and sets and everything. Mm-hmm. And so I took about 250 pictures off the video and then just kind of spread them around and used bits from them and, you know, kind of smeared them and everything. But it was a very exciting thing to do. And also Alan's writing that's written in the same rhythms as the ballet, the two together with the audience motif at the bottom. Yeah, I think it was wonderful fun to have a breakthrough like that with that piece.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Thank you.
I was also going to ask about the materials you used to make to illustrate the story, because you seem to jump around quite a bit for the different chapters and different styles and things. Like what were the different sort of media that you used?
Let's see. colored pencils, layered them quite extensively. And sometimes Pantone pens, you know, mixing those with the crayons or not. Sometimes a bit of acrylic paint, sometimes watercolors. A lot of the Alice chapters are done on watercolor paper. And so there's a more unsure line around them, a watery quality to them, which goes with the motif of the pools and the reflections that you have in the Alice chapters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, was there a theory behind the different types of material you would use with the different parts of the story? You just mentioned the Alice one as an example. Were there other places that you'd do stuff like that?
We figured out quite thoroughly what the colors and the seasons were for each of the girls and their motifs. Like I say, Alice's was reflected pools, and that starts from the very first kind of flashbacks, the oval shape of the panels and the colors. And Dorothy's are kind of Paris, Texas panorama, you know, with the golden colors and outdoor colors. And then the Wendy pieces are like stained glass windows. They're rigid, and Wendy is kind of caged within these very black lines. And I made sure that I didn't use very much black in the book at all until much later. But when I did use it, you know, it really had a nice constricting effect. I mean, black lines are very satisfying for the eye to look at, and they hold things down quite securely. But we also wanted a floaty feeling with a lot of the work. I'm hearing myself echoing, and it sounds like somebody else is starting the sentence and that I'm in the middle waiting for the end.
I'm sorry.
It's just a slight bit mental, but you know, I'm doing okay.
Yeah, we actually had somebody...
as long as I don't listen.
Yeah, well, we've had some technical difficulties. Someone played with the regular board that we use and basically ruined it, so we had to come into the office and do this. So.
Oh.
That's why.
Well, you have my sympathies, and I won't refer to it again. Anyway, where's I wandering? Oh, yeah, I was talking about the fact that I didn't use black lines with a lot of it because I wanted the quality of the art to have a misty feeling, like memory. You know, memory's kind of got soft edges, and it's made of, a lot of it's made of colored light, and, you know, we see things in a misty way when we're reminiscing. And so, anyway, I'm particularly proud of the Wendy chapters because I think they're wonderfully rigid and encapsulated, and I think it's really good use of black.
That's funny because I've read some of the writings that Baron's story did about illustrating, and he talked about when you isolate an image or outline an image, it kind of separates it from the background, and it becomes more of an idea than part of the story. So in ways that can sort of take it out of the continuity a bit, I guess.
Yeah, well, I know when I went from working with black and white stuff for so many years, and I played with it everywhere I could think of, but I almost always thought of black and white work as being at best kind of like Japanese, and in that the shapes and the weights of the lines and you know, the sensuousness that you can bring to it is part of the main fun of black line, but it was also really nice to get away from it and just treat it almost like more painterly work, even though I wasn't technically using paint. I was trying to go for something a bit different.
That's something I find interesting because you're, before getting into comics, you're kind of someone, from what I understand, kind of invited you into participate. I think it was in Women's Comics. But your history, you're a painter before then, am I correct in my research?
Yeah, I've been, I was always somebody who was interested in portrait art. I mean, I drew lots of comics that didn't have storylines in them when I was a kid. I do, like, visual storybooks and then staple them together, and I had hundreds of those. And then I started, like, writing little stories with people in them. But I kind of wanted to be an illustrator, and then I really wanted to do portraiture. And I have done a certain amount of paintings, but I've never bothered to really show anything because I just find it kind of nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I understand that.
And the last thing you want is for your friends to come and look at you with that glazed look and say, you do some really interesting stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that feeling.
She's okay, really. see. When you see me walking down the street, when the fellas want to speed, on their faces they wear silly spurs, 'cause they know I'm the king of a the moment of truth has finally come, when I'ma show you some of that cool shit. Now give me a little bit of drum by himself there. Now give me a little bit of bass with those 88s. Ah, you're cooking, baby. You're smoking. Now everybody, I want to hear you all.
Now, part of your the research with the project, one thing that I noticed was that your great, I guess, imitation of the Marquis von Beyeros.
Ah.
Now, it's a name I hadn't really heard, and then I actually found a book by accident from, like, 68, this huge tome of his work. And I was wondering, was there any, because he's pretty obscure. Was there any other kind of obscure stuff? And what was the interest with the Marquis?
Well, I first came across a book of his, I think, was it Metropolis or something? I think a French company reproduced a lot of his work. And I found a book of his in Amsterdam. And I left it on somebody's chair with some other books to be sent back to me. And when I visited the guy, like 7 years later, that stack of books was still sitting on that chair. But I did remember him, and I saw a New York published version of the same book, so I picked that up and got to read a bit of it in English. But, yeah, he's a fantastic artist. I mean, I lucked out. I went down to Cecil Court in London here and just picked up, I think, two books of his. They just both happened to be floating around that area, and one was a privately published small edition book, and the other one was another version of this New York French one. But anyway, he was fascinating, and that was the hardest thing in the whole book to do, was that pastiche of von Beyeros. I mean, there's one picture where there's a lady wearing a big skirt, and there's tiny little ejaculating penises and patterns all over it. I felt like I was doing the forbidden stitch. I'd have to sit and ink it in and then get up and walk around in about 15 minutes. I had to get up quite often. Otherwise, I'd feel like my head was clenching into a tiny little knot.
Yeah, because I noticed with his illustrations that he does, that you totally mirrored that really well with the little details in the corner that if you're not paying attention, you're going to miss it, you know?
Oh, absolutely. It was just the tiniest detail. The man must have had so much leisure time.
He was the Marquis.
Yes, he was, and he must have sat around just kind of blowing on the little golden frills on his blouse.
Were there any other, influences you brought in that we, might not have noticed? Because I read, you had a lot of trouble, researching, getting, appropriate period costumes and stuff. So what kind of stuff were you bringing in?
Well, let's see. I think there's only one female pornographer in there that we referenced, and that's Gerda Wegener. She did the Queens Together bit, the little sweet illustrations. there's only been about 8 or 9 of her illustrations ever published, and they're usually very often ascribed to anonymous if they're in a Taschen book. But she had quite a nice feel to her stuff. Yeah, it was very hard to find things that weren't just anonymous. There's been a certain amount of very nice pornographic art, but very often you won't see the artist's name on them. So we did do the chapter that was called Anonymous, but finding things that were named were difficult.
It's almost like it's in one part, you know, an epic story, and another part it's a tribute to a certain art form
and a time period.
Yeah, like a tribute to the art form and the time period.
Sorry, what was the first part?
It seems in one part it's Lost Girls is you know, it's an epic comic doing the smart erotica. I don't know if smart erotica is the right term, but it also seems like the both of you are doing like a tribute to other artists in the past.
Oh yeah, very much so. And I mean, well, the Mooka stuff, for instance. I mean, I don't know if he ever did any erotic art, but probably like most artists, somebody in his family would have burned it if he had.
Yes.
We can only guess. But you know, Sheila is not really a big leap, is it? I mean, because he was kind of doing stuff like that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We were going to include the man who did a book called Pornocrates. Alan, what was his name? Lucian Ropes.
Hmm.
Felician Ropes, sorry. R-O-P-S. And I did do a couple of illustrations, but the thing was, he was pornographic and anti-religious. And so he didn't really do very much pornography that wasn't offensive to the church as well. And we didn't want to get into that, because then we'd have to write something that was anti-religious, and we, you know, that wasn't. We figured we were covering enough with pornography.
Yeah.
You know? We'll leave somebody to do the naked anti-papal stuff.
Yeah. Actually, I think the one thing that I will say that I missed from The Lost Girls is I was hoping to have, 50 pages of footnotes at the end telling me all about these different erotic artists.
Well, I don't know whether Jess Nevins is going to be bothering with Lost Girls. I think he's got a lot on his plate now, but...
Now, I'm curious kind of how you... cover a little bit of your background, like how you originally got into comics.
Well, let's see. I went to Golden Gate Park one year when Lee Mars from Women's Comics had a little booth there, and they were looking for more women artists. And I happily joined up and started going to the Women's Comics meetings, and I think I was in, I can't remember exactly how many issues I was in. I think I started in issue 5 or 6 and ended up being with them maybe 4 or 5 issues. And then I got into a few of the titles that were done by the guys, because we only had the 2 girls' comics. And I can't remember the name of the other one. It came about later. Oh, Wet Satin, yeah. There's a funny story behind Wet Satin. Do you remember about Wet Satin? Did you ever hear of it?
No, I didn't, actually.
Well, it was supposed to be the women's erotic comic. And there was a publisher out in Wisconsin who had won an award for bravery in comics, because he'd actually published a comic that featured a giant, I believe it was a giant vulva eating the Empire State Building.
Awesome.
Well, that's great, and that's good to be brave. They brought the first issue of Wet Satin in, and it had a cover by Trina Robbins of a girl eating a banana watching Marlon Brando on a skateboard or something. And this guy wouldn't print it because it featured a story of mine in there called Cockpit, which I think he was particularly offended by, because it was about, Oh, I think it was based on Peter Brooks's Murat Saad. The play about the
Maquis.
Yes. And as Charenton and all that, and it was full of mad people and sex and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, he found this offensive, and he wouldn't publish Wet Satin. So even though he won an award for bravery in printing, so that was Wet Satin. That was the other title that we women did. But I got invited into some other titles like Slow Death and Young Lust and some other things like that.
Now, was it Tits and Clits that had the massive controversy and lawsuits?
Did they have lawsuits? What was that about?
I thought it was Tits and Clits that, like...
Yeah, I think they had some sort of, they were deemed offensive or something in some place. Some place with a bunch of crazies deemed it offensive or something.
It wasn't Rome, Georgia again, was it?
Oh, it could, very well could have been.
Rome, Georgia seems to be a hotbed for anti-art and anti-comics and stuff.
No fun.
Yeah. Actually, I was going to ask, what was your first exposure to, like, comic books and art? Like, were there any things, like, the first time that you saw these things as, like, that it really grabbed you?
I liked classics illustrated, especially the one about Jane Eyre. That was the first time I ever saw the story of Jane Eyre, and I really liked the idea of a schoolteacher ending up, you know, with a kind of this big devil man who brooded all the time and a mad woman upstairs in the attic. It all sounded like great fun and, you know, mysterious fires and everything.
Sounds like my home life.
Hmm?
That just sounds like my life. Anyway.
I also remember, yes, I'm very much like the Archie comics, Betty and Veronica, all that stuff. I remember buying those when I was like 9 and 10. And, you know, they were quite cool. And, you know, especially the Christmas annual where Betty or Veronica would always wear like some red cashmere sweater. And, oh, it's just very teenagey, you know. It's.
Now, where were you from originally?
Well, I grew up in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, technically in a little town called Sausalito.
Oh, yeah.
Which was great, because I used to wander all over the town when I was really, really small. Child molestation was not a thing that happened at that point.
Yeah.
And so children had a lot easier time of it. You could go where you wanted and, you know, pretty much got left alone.
What actually instigated your move to England?
I had an English boyfriend, and we came over here to visit his parents and just get away for a vacation. And then I ended up getting work on a film, and I stayed here.
The film was
When the Wind Blows.
Oh, that was the Raymond Briggs?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that makes sense, because your style totally fits with that. Because when I heard that you worked in animation, I thought it was kind of a strange mix, but now it makes sense to me.
Oh, right. Oh, God, yeah. Talk about layering. My God. And this was before all the computer stuff, so everything was still done painfully by hand. I met people in the field who, this poor woman, I wanted to take animation classes from her, and she said, listen, you've got to understand that probably the best thing that's ever going to happen to you if you stay in this field is that someday you may have a chance to make your own 10-minute film before you die.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
And I said, well, that doesn't sound, you know, like much fun. And she said, well, you're going to have a hard time even being able to sell your own character types. You're mostly going to be just copying somebody else's work, you know.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Now, returning to Lost Girls, fantasy, the importance of fantasy, I see that. Was that an important function in making sure that, like, because it's up for men and women, to have fantasy such an important part of it?
Yeah, I think anticipation, fantasy, desire, all these things that happen before people actually get to the act are really the meat of the whole thing. I think the more we have a chance to actually use our imagination to heighten this object of desire, I mean, that's the whole coloration on the apple, isn't it? I mean, this is after long cogitation, we came to that conclusion that really it's not winning the race, it's contemplating it and then the slow crawl towards it that actually constitutes everything that ends up being made into great art and sometimes war.
Yeah.
You know, the anticipation, the desire, the fear of not being able to consummate, you know,
yeah.
The terrible attachment,
the
exquisite piercing beauty, et cetera, you know. This is where we live. This is where we're existing inside this capsule of poetry that is our sexual and romantic imagination.
It's funny, too, because it's, I mean, for the amount of time that people think about sex, because I'm pretty sure people think about sex all the time, that there really are very, there's next to no art based on sex that's even worth looking at. You know, like it's there is, but it's so few and far between, it's not funny.
Well, I think it's a separation between our greatest impulses and what manifests through our bodies once those impulses have been charged up. We have separated this process into fractured bits where the top part of the bit is okay, but the way it manifests through the human organism is wrong, wrong, wrong. So it's a matter of reattaching everything properly. I mean, we need our food supplies. We need everything that we're connected up to do. All of these processes are miraculous and beautiful sort of things, but we have to have the right eyeballs in our head. We have to have the right thinking going on inside so that we can understand things in their beauty and their wholeness.
I agree 100%. That's I was talking with somebody the other day about how some people I know are very damaged in a way because there's never any class you take when you're growing up to learn how to react sexually to something or feel comfortable or what, you know, there's no rules. So it's really a hit, you know, it's just a trial and error, you know.
Absolutely.
I was also going to ask about the one thing in The Lost Girls I noticed was that like the hotel is kind of a fantasy area, and I noticed that there's no heterosexuals in the hotel. but it's funny because like everybody is either experimenting sexually or doing something that they wouldn't do otherwise or learning or opening up their minds. But when they talk about their most exciting fantasies, they're mostly heterosexual and kind of uncomfortable, you know, from the past. And I was wondering if that was intentional.
Well, I know there was the one sequence where there's lots of kind of hetero activity in the thing where the letter starts, where Harold is writing his letter about how boring everybody is, and all the maids and the butlers and the assistants are scuttling around having sex in the closets in various rooms and stuff.
Yeah, but I noticed that as the story progressed, there were less and less heterosexuals in the hotel. You know, I just noticed it was just an observation. So.
I don't know. I mean, where was I? I must have been there. I don't know whether it was a decision or whether these things just happened because we thought, oh, this will be fun.
Yeah.
know, and actually, that was as far as it went. Oh, let's do that. That'd be good, well, you know. And so that's what happened.
It does make sense, though, because it wouldn't be fun if you had a bunch of boring people there that just wanted to, you know, a bunch of missionary people. That would be kind of that'd be kind of boring.
Yeah, well, it, you know, it, some of that kind of stuff has been done, isn't it?
Well, it is true, though. I noticed that it does. I mean, the part with the war at the end where it kind of goes when the fantasy ends and it becomes more like reality with the introduction of the war coming. I do notice that like the even the soldiers, they're heterosexual. You know? I'm assuming they were anyway. So that's kind of, even that's a little bit like the they're almost the enemy at times.
I guess you got kind of talk about like a balance or something.
I don't know what the soldiers were. I think they were just kind of fed up and smelly, probably, you know, and wishing they weren't eating tinned horse meat.
Now, the characters you draw, the men are very androgynous. Is that a purposeful technique within the storytelling of part of that fantasy element?
Sorry, with the two men?
No, the male characters predominantly in Lost Girls are androgynous, it seems to me. Is that kind of like a purposeful thing?
Yeah. I don't know. No, I mean, specifically, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question specifically. I'll give you an answer to what I think you said. Are you asking specifically about Harold and Rolf?
Just the male theme characters. They would be the predominant. But even like the butlers and stuff, they have a very androgynous look to them.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Did you say interogenous or heterogenous?
Androgynous.
Androgynous, sorry. I misunderstood you on two counts. Okay. Yeah, I guess it's just the way I draw them.
I'm reading too much into things.
I think more things happen to people when they're kind of in an androgynous state. I think if you're wearing a mask of some kind of definite sexual thing that you're projecting, and a lot of the times when I was drawing people, I was kind of drawing the state they're in and not just what they physically look like. So that accounts for some of the reason why people morph a little bit, because it's kind of an emotional, you're seeing through emotional eyes, you know, the way people change before you when you're acutely watching them. You know, and you think, oh, for a moment he looked almost like a cat bear, or you know what I mean?
I also saw it as like the more you get to know somebody, the more you can, the more you appreciate the changes, or you can see the changes in them.
Yeah.
Since it's a radio show, I usually play music. Is there any particular songs you'd like us to play before and after the interview when I air it?
Oh, one song or two?
Maybe even three.
Three?
Yeah, pick three.
Three? Oh, my God. Well, let's see. One would have to be Hallelujah, It's Raining Men by the Weather Girls. one would have to be Cool Jerk.
Cool Jerk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
I remember that one, yeah.
The other, let's see, Dr. John, Walk on Gilded Splinters.
Oh, really? Awesome. I love Dr. John.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I DJ'd at a gay club once, and I remember playing Raining Men, and all the old guys were happy because they don't get to hear the disco anymore, so.
Oh.
I want to thank you for taking the time with us to speak with us about Lost Girls.
It's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And sorry about the sound. Maybe if we do this again, we'll have the sound sorted out next time.
Oh, well, I really enjoyed talking to both of you.
Actually, a quick question before you go is I was going to ask what you were going to be doing next.
Oh, well, there's several things. I'm sort of writing a book about my life in San Francisco and a bit beyond. And I'm also doing some painting, portraiture, things like that. So kind of got two things going on. The book will have like sort of a lot of photographs and drawings in it and things like that.
I love that, actually. I find that more and more I'm looking towards comics as just one part of a way of telling a narrative, and I love mixing in other things as well. I find that fascinating.
Oh, good. Yeah, I do too. I think it's really exciting to put textures together, you know, visual and verbal, and it just makes it a much, much more sort of toothy and satisfying experience, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you could play to the strengths of each thing that you're using. You know, I'd love that.
Yeah, all good.
Actually, and you're also, I think I read somewhere doing something, I think Alan's doing like a magic, I don't know, not manual, but like a little book about magic, and you're doing a piece for that, if I...
I am doing a piece for that, and it's the Bumper Book of Magic. It's going to be a huge and miraculous book. John Coulthard has sent us the projected cover for it, and our publisher is over the moon. I think it's going to be utterly magical, you know, really, really good in a really exciting way. I'm going to be doing a magical palace in pop-up form, I think, towards the back of the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I actually find that I've read some of the interviews with Alan when he's talking about magic, and I found it fascinating. I thought I was going to go, oh, boy, this is dumb or something, and I loved them. I thought they were just, almost inspiring. They were so interesting.
I think we'll all find this to be quite an amazing book.
Well, we look forward to it very much, and thank you once again for taking the time to join us.
And thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking to both of you. It was great fun.
Think they jive me, but I know they must be crazy. Don't see their misfortune, else they just lazy. Je suis a grand zombie, my yellow belt of Charizard. Ain't afraid of no tomcat, fill my brains with poison. Walk through the fire, fly through the smoke. See my enemy at the end of the walk on pins and needles, see what they can do. Walk on gilded splinters with the cane of the Zulu. Dang a man, a con, make it a con, con. Walk on gilded splinters. Did I put my coffin, drink poison in my chalice. Pride begins to fade, and y'all feel my malice. Put gree-gree on your doorstep, soon you'll be in the gutter. Melt your heart like butter, I can make you stutter. Think about a corn, may kill it, corn, corn. Walk on, kill the splinter. Walk on, may kill it, corn, corn. Walk on, kill the splinter. Family, you find them, the course.
la chandelle de la vie caraba. Padre Diablo, Grand Congo. Grabos on the brow.